So Krishna says, yesterday we were talking about, you know, you don't have to write this. This is just a recap, okay? He's talking about the thermos bottle. He says, yesterday we were talking about a subtle form of the thermos bottle and a grosser form of the thermos bottle. And what appears to you is the grosser form of the thermos bottle. And behind it, there's a more subtle form of the thermos bottle. He says, it's similar to the idea of chumbap in Madhyamika, in middle way, which is the glass of water, the glass of liquid, sorry. And that's where three people are. The name of that section is really the river, which means humans see a river as water and pretas see it as blood and pus. So it's very similar to the idea in middle way school when you're talking about three people sitting around a table, a deity, a human, and a preta, looking at the same glass of liquid and seeing three different things. So he said it's a very similar idea, but this is a different concept in the Mainoni school. This is a unique idea to the Mainoni school, but it sort of parallels that idea in the middle way school. Some crucial points of the two examples are similar, but I'm not trying to say that they are in every way the same. He says, yesterday when we were in the middle of some issues, Dr. Chilton, you know, looked like he had a question to raise or something occurred to him that he wanted to talk about, and then he wonders if you remember what it was that you'd like to talk about in some kind of issue yesterday. He thinks it may have related to the second interpretation of what it means to exist ultimately or as the ultimate. And he says, I think it occurred with regard to, you know, my question, which is kind of koanish, which was, you know, where is it that emptiness is like that? Where is it that we were talking about totality or emptiness, and we're saying, and my question to you was, where is it that it was empty? And then we kind of got off on, you know, where, what does it mean to be, where, what does it mean when you say where is emptiness, or in what locale is emptiness like that? And Geshe-la says it might help you. He says, I judge that to have been your issue, something to do with that. And he says, it might help you if you think of the ultimate here as ultimate reality or ultimate truth, and then think about to whom is it true or who establishes it as true. You see what I mean? Think of ultimate in terms of ultimate reality or ultimate truth, and then think about for whom is it true or to whom is it true. And then you'll come up with that state of mind, which is the direct perception of emptiness, and that's where the emptiness is. Lari. Lassa. He says that you have to climb the ladder on three rungs. You have to go up step by step. You know, you have to do this. This question and the question I answered yesterday about it has to be approached in a very gradual way, or in three discrete stages, in three discrete steps. First question is, in the second interpretation of what it is to be, to exist ultimately, you have to identify the as ultimate or ultimately. What is the ultimate you're talking about? You have to identify that as being ultimate reality or ultimate truth. So the first step is to identify what it what we're talking about. We're talking about ultimate reality. We're talking about ultimate reality. Second one is you have to identify what you're talking about when you say ultimate reality, and that is you're talking about emptiness. Okay, so you're talking, when they talk about existing ultimately or existing as ultimate, it means existing as ultimate reality. And then you have to identify that ultimate reality as being emptiness. And then the third step is you have to identify to whom is it true. Okay, to whom are we talking about? Na dhamma di yondu vina, dhamma nipadi dhanandama yima, na tusha. Dhanandam se, dhanandam se, dhanandam. Nani, yondu che, ani dhamma yis, ta su na dhamma. Nani, nani. Lassa, lassa, lassa. Lassa. I have to redo that, okay? Sorry. I realized halfway through I got messed up. We're talking about three steps, okay? The first step is to identify what it is that we're talking about in the second interpretation when we say this exists as ultimate or as ultimately. And we have to identify what it is we're talking about. We're talking about yondu, okay? In the second case, we're talking about totality or emptiness. And then the second step there is to identify, is to equate that to ultimate reality or ultimate truth. Okay, so you start out by saying, this is, you start, the first step on the three steps of the ladder is to say the object being talked about here is emptiness or yongju, okay, totality. And then the second step is to identify that as equivalent to ultimate reality or ultimate truth. Okay, which in the case of the first, in the case of the first interpretation of this, it's not, right? So secondly, you identify as ultimate truth. And when you identify it as ultimate truth or ultimate reality, then you have to say to whom or who establishes it as ultimate reality, who establishes it as ultimate truth, to whom or in what circumstances or in what place, in what locale, meaning to what state of mind is it ultimate reality or ultimate truth, because trueness or truth is established by a state of mind. So he says, Roy got very close to the third. Roy stated the third one yesterday, but he wanted it to be go through more clearly through these steps. What does ultimate mean here? Emptiness. What is emptiness? Ultimate truth or ultimate reality. What establishes it as being true or reality? Who is it? To whom? Where is it? In a sense, or where does it have to be identified as true or reality? Deep meditative state of an ayah who's perceiving emptiness directly. Okay, so that's the process he wanted to go through, and that's what he was trying to get at yesterday when he wanted to go through those steps.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. To just put it simply, in the second interpretation of what it means to exist ultimately, that ultimate refers to ultimate reality or to emptiness itself. Okay, very totality. Very simply put, that's it. If something is totality, it is what the second interpretation of ultimate is talking about. If something is not totality or emptiness, it is not what the second interpretation of ultimate is talking about. And that's all. Okay, nothing. Nothing. Now there's that second step. You see, you say, what is emptiness? Emptiness is ultimate reality or ultimate truth. And then the natural question is, to whom? Who can identify it as ultimate truth? Who can identify it as ultimate reality? Who identifies its trueness? Who establishes its trueness? And then you get finally to the direct perception of emptiness. That state of mind, the direct perception of emptiness, establishes it as being true or ultimate. Don't mix up those three steps. Try to keep them separate. Emptiness, ultimate reality, and to whom ultimately real. And those are three. He wants to make those three very discrete steps. Now we come to page 56, second line. We're picking up where we left off yesterday. We're at the book by Maitreya called Distinguishing Between the Middle and the Extremes, Madhyanta Vibhanga. Okay, and it says there are two different objects of the purity, and they are spoken to be only one. Okay. So there are two different objects of the purity, and they are spoken to be only one. Now we just got through saying that in the second interpretation of what it means to exist ultimately, the ultimate here, or to exist as the ultimate here is referring to emptiness or totality. So among the three different attributes of the mind-only school, you'd have to say that only one of them is what the second connotation of existing ultimately refers to, and that's totality or emptiness, okay? It's only that one. It cannot be dependent things, and it cannot be constructs, okay? They cannot be what these words are. They cannot be what the second interpretation of existing ultimately refers to. And now Jetsun Khamsa is going to back it up, okay? And now he says, hey, because they are said in Scripture to be only one, okay? They're said in Scripture that the ultimate is only one, meaning only one of the three groups, only one of the three attributes, okay? So then he says, because Madhyanta Vibhanga says there are two different objects of the purity, and they are spoken to be only one. Okay, so Geshe-la says this can be a little bit confusing because it says two different, you see, and that can be confusing because you could take it to mean two of the three attributes of the mind-only school or the groups of the mind-only school are described here as being ultimate. You know, you would think that, but that's not what it's saying. When it says two here, when it says the objects of the purity are two, of two different types, here they're talking about two different types of yogdu. Okay, they're talking about two different types of totality or two different types of emptiness. Okay, what are the two different types of emptiness that can appear to the purity, meaning the path of purity, meaning the direct perception of emptiness? One is the lack of self-nature, the subtle lack of self-nature to a person, and one is the subtle lack of self-nature to things, meaning the parts of a person in this case, okay? So when the book says, by Maitreya says, you know, the object of purity is of two types, they're talking about the subtle lack of self-existence to a person and the subtle lack of self-existence to things. And then it goes on to say, and that's only one, and that can be only one. That is said to be only one, but one. And that one means only one of the three groups. You see what I mean? So then he says, and that's only one, meaning only one of the three groups can be identified as ultimate in the sense of existing ultimately in the sense, in the second interpretation of that phrase. Okay? And that only refers to yongdu or totality or emptiness. Okay? Nothing. There seems to be a difference of opinion on whether or not both of those two kinds of a lack of self-nature are yongdu, okay, are totality. And there seems to be some difference between the Saramade books and the Saramade books. And says, you know, as this guy said, I said, well, which one is it? He says, I don't know, different people say different things, you know, they quote different parts of the book and they try to establish. We'll get on to it later. He's saying, we'll get on to it later, whether or not in actuality we can describe both kinds of a subtle lack of a self-nature as being totality or not in this school, given this school. Nothing. There's different places where you can find different references that support the idea that totality only refers to the subtle lack of self-nature of things and not to the subtle lack of self-nature of persons. And then Geshe-la says there are two such references. I've been looking around for both of them. I can only find one. I'll tell you the one I found. It's page 23, the very, very last syllables. It says, when the text, meaning the sutra on the intent of the sutras, talks about dharmas or objects, what it's talking about is totality. And what it's saying is that totality only refers to the lack of self-nature to things. Those words from the sutra on the intent of the sutras are meant to state, or are meant to say, that the totality only refers to the subtle lack, or to the lack of self-nature of things. Okay, that's one of the two classical references that are used by those parties who say, oh, it only refers to emptiness or totality in the mind-only school, only refers to the lack of self nature of things. Okay. Not so good. Line 3, page 56, where we just went, where it said, you know, the object of the purity is two, as of two different types. That's where the Sarajevas go and say, hey, no, it's both kinds of a lack of self-nature, because it says right there in the Madhyanta Vibhanga, you know, that there are two different types, meaning totality or emptiness in the mind-only school refers to both the subtle lack of self-nature of things and the subtle lack of self-nature of persons. Okay. Once you say that that there can be a lack of self-nature of the person, which is yongdrup, or totality, then you would have to say that there can be a lack of nature, self-nature of a person, which could be emptiness itself. Then you'd have to say that there are two types of emptiness, right? The lack of self-nature of things and the lack of self-nature of persons. And in the same manner, there are two different types of totality. That totality which is a subtle lack of self-nature of objects, and a totality which is a subtle lack of self-nature of persons. And then the commentary comes. Now, as we said yesterday, whenever in this book, normally, when you get to quote the commentary of distinguishing between the middle and the extremes, it's going to be the one by Master Vasubandhu. And here he says, now this one that we're talking about, this one and only that we're talking about, meaning one and only one of the three groups, which can just be described as ultimate in the second interpretation of what it is to exist as ultimate, right? So in that second interpretation, that only one which can be described as, which is yongdrup, right? Emptiness, which is the only one which can be described as ultimate in the second sense of the term, among the three groups, right? Only one among the three groups. And then it says, it can be divided in, the other two are not, cannot be described here as the ultimate in the second sense of the term, because they do not qualify as one of the objects of the two, it says here, of the two knowledges of purity. Okay? The other two groups, meaning dependent things and constructs, cannot be described as ultimate in the second sense of the term, because they do not qualify as objects of the two knowledges of purity. Okay, and then I ask Geshe-la, you know, why are they talking about two knowledges of purity? He says, hey, look, we're talking about that direct perception of emptiness, which is focusing on the lack of self-nature of objects, and that direct perception of emptiness, which is focusing on the lack of self-nature of persons. Okay, and that's why here you can say the other two groups in the mind-only school don't qualify as ultimate here, because they are not one of the two objects of those of those respective two states of mind which are perceiving emptiness directly. Okay? Nothing. Now, Jetsun Kapa himself says, what are they talking about when they say the objects of the two different kinds of knowledge of purity, right? He himself wants to know, you know, what is that thing? That's his next statement. Okay, we're on page 56. We're on the sixth line from the bottom. And Jetsun Kapa himself says, hey, do you want to know what those two knowledges of purity refers to? He says, they are those two which purify you or make you pure of the two kinds of obstacles. Okay, they purify your being of the two kinds of obstacles. And then Geshe La clarifies by saying, look, what are the two kinds of obstacles? You guys know. First are called the obstacles of the mental afflictions, which are obstacles to achieving nirvana. And then the obstacles of the knowledge, okay? Which means, until you get rid of those, you cannot become omniscient. So these are you eliminate those in two stages, okay? With one set of perceptions of emptiness, through a particular direct perception of emptiness, you are enabled, it enables you to eliminate in yourself those obstacles which relate to mental afflictions. And then through perceiving another kind of emptiness, or through a different kind of perception of emptiness, you purify yourself of those obstacles to omniscience, which prevent you from becoming an omniscient being. And there you get the sense of pure. Okay, that's why they call the path of purity, because they allow you or they enable you to purify yourself of these two obstacles. And then Geshe-la goes on to make a very interesting statement that it's the direct perception of the lack of self-nature of a person which allows you to eliminate the first set of obstacles, okay? Which allows you to eliminate the obstacles that relate to mental afflictions and therefore obstacles to achieving only nirvana, okay? And then the direct perception of the lack of self-nature of things, which happens later, enables you to eliminate those obstacles which prevent you from becoming omniscient. Okay, so he says by Jetsun Kapa, by saying that these two knowledges of purity refer to those two states of mind that enable you to eliminate the two obstacles respectively, he's clearly stating by implication, right, that we're talking about the direct perception of the subtle lack of self-nature to a person, and then to the direct perception of the subtle lack of self-nature to things, respectively. And that, therefore, he clarifies for you what Geshe La just clarified for you. Yeah?
Does this apply to the mind only schools being only, or is this for
Madhamiki? Kansaki Dhamma Tamo Ngunsu Dutope Lu Nyundip Tso Bangkeng Yimba Dang Chiki Dhamma Tamo Ngunsu Dutope Lode Shiri Pambe Tap Tso Yimba Di Semtama Kyang Kyang Yimba Umapa Yang Kene Yerbe
No,
The lower group, the lower half of the middle way school, sides perfectly or exactly with the mind only school on this matter. Okay, they say that the direct perception of the subtle lack of a self to a person is what primarily enables you to eliminate obstacles to nirvana, obstacles of the mental afflictions, and the direct perception of the subtle lack of self-nature of things, or the parts of a person, it means here the parts of a person, is what enables you to eliminate those obstacles which prevent you from achieving omniscience. But in the higher half of the middle way school, the consequence group, don't forget that they believe that the tendency to see things as self-existent is a mental affliction. They believe that, and no one else believes that. Okay, they say that that is a form of a mental affliction. So you'd have to say that in the higher half of the middle way school, that they would say that it's the direct perception of the lack of self-nature of objects or things which enables you to eliminate the obstacles called mental affliction obstacles or obstacles to achieving nirvana, because they take that state of mind to be a, they take the tendency to see things as self-existent to be the ultimate mental affliction. In the consequence group of the middle way school, right, the Manimika Prasangika, they would divide it like this. They'd say, look, apart from a difference in the basis or the foundations of where you see the emptiness, meaning in one case you're focusing on a person, and in the other case you're focusing on other things, okay? Apart from those differences in the object which you are thinking about, what you understand about them both is the same thing. What? That they don't exist by definition. That they don't exist truly. So apart from a difference in what you're focusing on, those two states of mind, the direct perception of the subtle lack of self-nature of a person and the direct perception of the subtle lack of self-nature of objects, is they're the same. They have the same content. Okay, they're both thinking about their respective objects. Hey, this thing doesn't exist by definition. So the Manimika Prasangika would say those both act as a state of mind which enables you to prevent the mental affliction obstacles. Okay, so that's their thinking on it. Apart from the basis which has the emptiness, right? That when you perceive that emptiness, you're perceiving the same. The content of the mind is the same. They are both the opposite. Respective opposites of one state of mind which believes that a person could exist by definition and another state of mind that believes that things could exist by definition, they are described as opposite by content. Okay, they are looking at things the opposite way, which means they're both looking at the at different objects but in the same way. So Manimika Prasangika says that both of those direct perceptions of emptiness, both of those understandings of emptiness, act to enable you to eliminate the mental affliction obstacles. Nasa, Lundi. Nasa. Lundi, shit, you Nothing. Jetsokapa raises an issue and then answers it himself, okay? He says, somebody might come along and say this, and then here's my answer to them if they do say it, okay? By the way, Geshe-la, I'm translating as Jetsokapa. He's using the phrase, the incomparable gentle voice, Manjushri protector, Jetsokapa. I just want you to know that. Every time he says Jetsokapa, he goes through that whole phrase, okay? Anyway, he says Jetsokapa raises a potential issue and then addresses the potential issue himself. Okay, what is the potential issue? He says, don't forget that yesterday we talked about apperception, or the ability of the mind to know itself. And in there are about three different flavors of it, he says, you know. In Tibetan it's called Rang Rik, which means self-knowledge, okay, knowing yourself. And he says the first interpretation of what knowing yourself means, or you know, self-awareness, let's say, okay, self-awareness, is that here, out here is the perception of, you gotta look at this one, okay, out here is the perception, visual perception of blue, for example, and then behind it is somebody watching you seeing blue, okay, there's a state of mind watching yourself seeing blue, and that's one version of what it means to be self-aware, self-awareness. The other version of this, the other flavor of this, is that that awareness knows itself. The emphasis is on this, that one awareness is also knowing itself at the same time. So it's not so much one here and one behind. It's like this one is knowing itself as it sees. You see what I mean? And that's the second flavor of the meaning of self-awareness. And then I think he mentioned a third flavor, meaning, you know, in general, to know the very thing itself, meaning emptiness or something like that. That some people might refer to rangrik, knowing itself, as knowing emptiness itself or something like that, but he didn't stress that. Then he said, let's go on to that second interpretation of what it means to have self-awareness, which is that any particular state of mind would also be knowing itself at the same time, meaning being aware of itself. So the awareness of blue would also be aware of the awareness of blue, okay? And not just of blue. So the perception of blue is not only perceiving blue, it's also aware of the perception of blue, of the perceiving of blue at the same time, okay? Now, it's just Jetsokapa. Somebody might come and raise the following issue, okay? Didn't you say that there were these two kinds of states of mind that could perceive emptiness? You know, one seeing the emptiness of objects and one seeing the emptiness of persons, right? Didn't you say that? Yeah, I did. And so you said that what we're talking about, when we talk about ultimate in the second sense of the term, is totality in two different flavors, right? He said, right. So you talk about two different states of mind that see emptiness, right? He says, right. He says, do those two states of mind involve Rang Rik in this school? Okay, do they have self-awareness in this school? He says, yeah, they do. Oh, then they're not only perceiving emptiness, they're also perceiving themselves perceiving emptiness, right? And the guy says, yeah. You have to say, yeah. He says, well, then those perceptions themselves become the object of the path of purity, right? He says, right. So those perceptions themselves become ultimate in the second sense of the term, right? And he has to say, right. And so he says, so here you got a shenwang, right? A state of mind becoming yongdu, okay? Becoming totality or emptiness. Wouldn't this be a problem? Okay? If you define ultimate as ultimate reality or totality, and then you describe it as that object which the path of purity focuses on or sees, then wouldn't you have to say that mind itself, the perception of emptiness itself, being the object of the self-awareness of the that you're having during your perception of emptiness, well, doesn't that qualify then as, aren't you saying that that mind itself then is ultimate reality? Okay, that state of mind itself. So Justin Kama says somebody might raise this issue. Not so good. Geshe-la wants to clarify a few things. Yeah, he says, yeah, I was talking about three different flavors of self-awareness, okay? So you kind of get three different flavors of self-awareness here. And I didn't mean literally that one mind was sitting behind the other and, you know, watching the one mind, you know? But it helps you to visualize it that way or to think of it that way. Now, what does it mean literally when we say self-awareness, you know? Self-awareness. Is the perception of blue perceiving itself? And he says, no. Okay, there actually, it's a different state of mind, you see? There is an awareness of the awareness of blue, and then there's a separate state of mind called the awareness of blue. So there's the awareness of blue and the awareness of the awareness of blue. But they are so intimately related. You know, if you lost one, you would lose the other, right? They have what we call an inseparable relationship. They're so intimately related. And they're related even to the point of what we call ngo chik, meaning if you lost one, you would necessarily lose the other, okay? Then we can almost say that it is perceiving itself. And that's what the self and self-awareness is. This is not really itself, right? The perception of the perception of blue is not really, literally, the perception of blue. So technically, literally, you can't say it's perceiving itself. Okay? But they're so close and they're so intimately related that you can call it self-awareness. Okay? The basis of the trouble here, okay, the reason why this issue could easily arise is in a Tibetan phrase that's used to describe the direct perception of emptiness, okay? And that's a phrase called sosodran rinpa yeshe, meaning the wisdom which knows itself individually, okay? The wisdom that knows itself, wisdoms which know themselves individually, okay? Wisdoms which know themselves individually. Now, some thinkers take the individually, everybody takes that, what you saying? Some thinkers take the individually to mean that each of them would see themselves individually. Okay? Each of them would see themselves individually, meaning each perception of emptiness that you ever had would also see itself individually, meaning self-awareness, okay? But some other thinkers have taken the itself individually, meaning it itself perceives individually the emptinesses which pertain to every object. So big difference here, okay? When you say individually perceive itself, some people think it means each one of them sees themselves as a self-awareness or a self-perception, meaning that the direct perception of emptiness is also perceiving the direct perception of emptiness, okay? And then other thinkers have said, no, that's not what individually itself means at all. It itself is perceiving one by one each different kind of emptiness that pertains to each different kind of objects. You know, don't get confused here, okay? Those are two different ways of interpreting the phrase perceives emptiness itself individually, okay? And so different thinkers have had different takes on it, and probably the issue is arising from one of the takes on this phrase. Now it's time to answer the question, right? Jetsun Kapa has raised a question. Somebody has come along and raised a question. And probably you guys have been sitting there dying to get the answer, and we've been off on this tangent. So here we go back to the answer, to the question. Different people can eat the same food and taste two different things. So two different thinkers could have different understandings here. Jetsun Kapa is answering on the eighth line from the bottom on page 56. He says, look, I admit, you know, maybe it's true that the direct perception of emptiness in this school would have a quality of self-awareness. Okay. In this school, it would have a quality of self-awareness, meaning that the direct perception of emptiness would also be perceiving itself, would also be aware of itself. But Jetsun Kapa says, look, when we were talking about the meaning of ultimate, when we described the phrase existing as the ultimate or existing ultimately, we weren't talking about every single object that the direct perception of emptiness is involved with. Okay? We were talking more specifically about very special objects of the path of purity. You know, maybe the path of purity has other objects also. But when we talk about ultimate, we were talking about emptiness. You know, we didn't describe ultimate as every single object that the direct perception of emptiness perceives or is involved with. We were referring to a very specific object, and that was the emptiness. So when we say, like, individually perceiving itself or something like that, that individual, and we side with the people who say that individual has more the sense of the different emptinesses, okay? We're not emphasizing the self-aware part of that perception. We're emphasizing the fact that it perceives emptiness. So you have to know that when they say ultimate, they are referring only to that object which is emptiness. And they're not referring to every single thing that mind might be aware of or might be thinking about or something like that. Okay? And that might be pertaining to that state of mind. Okay. This thinkers who say what we've just said would admit that the direct perception of emptiness is also aware of itself. So these thinkers would say, look, nobody can deny that there are two objects here, okay? We're not denying that the direct perception of awareness is aware of the direct perception of awareness, you know? And we do agree that there are two separate objects going on here, okay? But don't forget how we describe these objects. We call them the object of the path of purity. The object of the path of purity. Object of a path. Path meaning in Buddhism spiritual realizations, okay? And when we're talking about spiritual realizations and spiritual realizations that are going to get you to these high goals, you know, we're not talking about the perception of yourself as being a path, okay? For the mind to perceive itself is not a spiritual path, okay? That's no big deal. You know, according to the Mind-Only School, all these states of mind are perceiving themselves. That doesn't qualify it as the path of purity or the object of the path of purity, because path implies a spiritual realization. So we're talking about not just any old object of the path of purity. We're talking about that object which makes it a path, which is emptiness. Okay, so that's when we say object of the path of purity, we have to be talking only about emptiness, totality. We're not talking about every other object that might be involved with that perception that wouldn't make it a path. Thinkers of this ilk, right? Thinkers of this type would give the following kind of example. Okay, they say, look, you guys over in America, you got this guy, this president of the United States of America. Okay, you got Mr. President. You know, you got this guy named Mr. President. Okay, and he sits in that Oval Office. You know, and he performs the functions. He does the activities. He does the work of the President of the United States of America. And that's why you can call him the President of the United States of America, because he's sitting in that chair and he's performing those functions, okay? So it wasn't like before he got elected president, he was even then a human being, okay? He was a guy, okay? Like, he didn't have to get to be president to be a guy. He was a guy before that, okay? So then the guy got elected president. After that, he sat in that chair, started to perform those functions, and only then you start talking about him as Mr. President, okay? So there's a guy who's been around for a while, and now he's the guy who's Mr. President, okay? And so then you have a big meeting here, and you know, you want to have a big international conference, and you want the President of the United States to come, and you invite this guy named Mr. President to come, okay? Now, you invite him by virtue of his being president. You don't invite him by virtue of his being a guy, okay? Like, it's not like you're not inviting him due to his quality of being a guy. You know, you're inviting him due to his quality of being Mr. President. Now, does he still have a quality of being a guy? Yeah. But what is the quality that everybody's focusing on when they say, please come to our international conference? It's the quality of being Mr. President, okay? And this is the same thing. Okay, there are other objects that this direct perception emptiness is involved with. Yeah, it is aware of itself. But that's not what we're focusing on when we talk about the path of purity. No, we're focusing on it as being something that, on its characteristic of being the direct perception emptiness. That's the point here, okay? There's other characteristics that it has, but that's not the one we're focusing on when we talk about path of purity. Okay? Same example. It says thinkers of the second group would give an example like this. So to tie up the example for you, here you have the direct perception of emptiness, okay? And over here you have itself as its object, Okay? The direct perception of emptiness is aware of the direct perception of emptiness. But it's also perceiving emptiness directly. Okay? So over here you got emptiness. Over here you got the direct perception of emptiness as an object of itself. And over here you got the direct perception of emptiness as a subject. Okay? So over here you got the guy. And over, you know, characteristic of being a guy. And over here you got the characteristic of being Mr. President. Now which one is it we're interested in? You know, we're holding an international conference. Which one are we going to invite? You know, on the basis of which one are we going to invite this guy here? It's this one. Come on, we're talking about the object of the path of purity, you know. We're talking about emptiness, you know. It's this one that we're focusing on. It's not this one, okay. It's not the fact, it's not that perception as its own object that we're interested in. It's, we're talking path of purity here. We're talking about something that gets you to a high spiritual state. We're talking about the emptiness here. We're talking about his characteristic of being Mr. President over here. Now we get on that second group that said, come on, you know, you don't have to do all these gymnastics about what the expression knowing itself individually means, you know. You don't have to go through all this stuff and say, oh, don't forget that Rang Rik, right, knowing itself, perceives itself also. You know, they said, come on, you're just misinterpreting the name of this mental state, which is called, you know, that knowledge of itself individually, right? The knowledge of itself individually. It's not talking about self-awareness, okay? Knowledge itself individually just means that that state of knowledge itself is perceiving individually all these different kinds of emptiness, okay? And that when, you know, the name itself doesn't in any way refer to self-awareness. It's just saying that knowledge itself knows all these objects individually. It's not saying this self-knowledge knows things individually, okay? It's not like that. That's not at all what it's talking about. And so the second group of thinkers would say, you know, you have to do all these gymnastics to talk about the object which it is seeing, but it's not the main one, and the object which it is seeing, which is the main one. You don't have to go through that. You've just misunderstood the name of the thing. You misunderstood the name of the state of mind itself. The Rang, in Sosa Rang Rinpoche Yeshe, it doesn't refer to self-awareness. It just means it itself perceives all these different kinds of emptiness. So you don't have to go through all this stuff. Okay? No, sir. Geshe-la corrects me on one point, okay, or he clarifies a certain point. I said about the second group of thinkers that they think that the word rang, meaning self, means those states of mind themselves perceive all those individual objects. He says, let's clarify it, that that word itself, self, means it sees those objects themselves, okay? Not that it itself sees those objects individually, but rather that it sees those objects themselves individually. And Geshe-la says, you know, I don't know how it is in English. I don't know about the word self or themselves or itself or yourself. But in Tibetan, you can use ngarang means myself. And you can say kurang meaning themselves, you know. And you can say selves either way. And then I said, yeah, it's about the same in English, right? So he said, you can think about the first group of thinkers as thinking that the word self refers to myself, meaning the mind perceives itself or myself. I, being that state of mind, perceive myself, meaning that state of mind, okay? You can think of the first self as that, you know? And then in the second sense of self, you can think of it is perceiving those objects themselves out there, and that's how you can take the word self. And that those two ways of interpreting the word self give you a very clear idea of how the two groups of thinkers think about, are treating this question. It's how they, it revolves around the question of what do you mean when you say self? Okay? In the expression, those knowledges which perceive, and now it gets difficult, right? The knowledges of self individually, right? The self, the knowledges of self individually, how's that? It's nothing like that. Okay? Now it gets a little tricky in English. Okay. Nothing. So now we are, you know, we're going to do this whole long spiel, you know. Let's boil it down to the basics, okay? Let's boil it down to what it means. You got two different ideas here. One set of guys would come up and say, anything which is the object of the path of purity, right? Which is how ultimate in the expression, in the second interpretation of what it meant to exist ultimately was described. One set of guys comes up and says, anything which is the object of the path of purity is ultimate, the ultimate. Okay, so one group can come along and say that, right? One group can properly come along and say, if something is the object of the path of purity, it is necessarily and always the ultimate, right? And then you got this other group that comes has to come along and say, they can't say that, right? They have to come along and say, if something is the object of the path of purity, it is not necessarily the ultimate. It could be the ultimate, doesn't have to be ultimate. And you say, oh, give me an example. Which one are you talking about? Which one do you have a problem with? You know, what is it that, what are you having in mind when you say it's not necessarily the case? What exception are you thinking of? And they say, hey, you know, there are objects of the path of purity which are not the ultimate. And you say, what? And they say, oh, it's that perception itself, when the perception is having self-perception. Because it's also being aware of itself. It's also perceiving itself. And that's not the ultimate. That's a mental thing. That's a state of mind. And then Jetsun Kapa says, when you get to a position of where you're talking to these guys who just said that, then ask them, well, what do you think the words path of purity are focusing on? You know, any old path? I mean, any old object? I mean, when you talk about path, you're talking about spiritual realization. So do you think when we talk about the object of the path of purity, we're just talking about any old object of the path of purity? We're talking about the object that makes it a path or a spiritual realization, and that's emptiness. So Jessica is saying, that's how you have to answer that group of people. That's okay. Was that a decent summarization of the point? Yeah? Okay. Maybe. The group that comes along and says, yeah, we admit that it has two objects that it perceives. We admit that it perceives itself also, okay? But we admit that in a sense it has two different objects. It has itself as its object, and it has emptiness as its object. But really, among those two objects, only one of them is extraordinary and special and wonderful, you know? And that's the emptiness, okay? The people who say it that way, the people who interpret these lines that way, the people who present the position that way are the Sarah J. scholars. Okay, that's the popular position of the Sarah J. scholars. Okay. Don't tell anybody, okay? Now you have to follow this position. Then there are the thinkers from Serame, and the thinkers, for example, from the Losalin College of Debu Monastery, and they side with the other group, and they say, look, this is not talking about apperception here. You know, when it says itself, it means themselves, meaning it sees those emptinesses as themselves. It's not at all talking about a state of apperception here. So the Sarame textbooks and the Losalin College textbooks kind of side on the, with the other group there. And not only those two colleges, but also the Gomon College of Debu, and most of those Amdo guys, they also side with us. You call it to me. Page 56, right in the middle, 8 lines from the bottom. But how did Jetsun Kapa answer? Okay, don't forget that Jetsun Kapa answered. He said, "You know, which object do you think is prominent or most important when we call something the direct perception of emptiness or the path of purity? You know, which of the objects do you think it is that we're talking about when we say it's the object of the path of purity? Now, when you talk about the path of purity, based upon which object do you think we give it that high name? You know, meaning that there are more than one object. Meaning that Jetsun Kapa didn't come along and say, hey, there's only one object here. You know, who's talking about a perception of yourself as an object? You know, who's talking about yourself as an object that you yourself perceive? We didn't mention it. He did not answer like that. Okay, rather he said, well, you know, which object do you think it was based upon? Based on which object do you think we call this thing the path of purity, the object of path of purity? Now, if you focus on that line, you kind of have to go towards the Sarajaya interpretation here because it seems closer. Otherwise, Jetsun Kapa would have answered and said, hey, they're not talking about objects like that. You know, they're not talking about yourself as an object of your direct perception of emptiness or anything like that. He didn't say that. He said, now, you have to figure out which object it is that you're talking about. When you say which object, you're implying multiple objects. When you apply multiple objects, you start getting real close to the Sarajaya interpretation. Mm-hmm. Have to admit. I'll give an example. I don't want to waste time. Am I wasting time? I said no. He said, okay, we're not wasting time. Okay, well, let's give an example, an illustration. All right? Suppose you call a meeting of the monks, you know, and special monks, you know, like qualified monks. You know, you're having a meeting of special monks who there's a special purpose for it, and you're having this meeting, okay? And then you say everybody who's qualified has to come. You know, everybody that has, you know, these qualifications has to come to the meeting. So some guy, you know, puts together a dummy, a mannequin, you know, like he sews cloth together and puts hay in it or something and brings along this guy, holds his arm around this guy and drags him to the meeting, you know. And then what'll the other people say? They say, come on, are you crazy? You know, this is not even a guy, you know. This is just a dummy, you know. We don't need this guy in the meeting, okay? We don't need this dummy in the meeting, okay? What are you doing? Are you crazy, you know? That's one example, okay? Then suppose some guy goes to, you know, camp number three or something, and meets some lay person there who has nothing to do with the monastery, and says, oh, we're having a meeting today, you know, come with me, you know, come along with us, you can come to the meeting. So then he walks into this meeting of specially qualified monks with this lay person who doesn't know anything what's going on, you know, and what's everybody going to say? He's like, well, what are you doing here, you know? He says, hey, I'm a guy, you know, I thought this was a meeting of anybody who's a guy. He says, hey, we have to admit you're a guy, you know, you're a person, you know, but we call this meeting for monks of certain qualifications, and not just anybody who's a guy, not just anybody who's a person, okay? So that's a very, very similar example here. So which answer did Jesakava give here? It's like he's saying, you know, okay, the guy got brought from the camp, you know, the lay person who's not even a monk and no qualifications anyway, and he got brought to the meeting, you know, and Jetson Kava's like the guy running the meeting, and he's saying, you know, what are you doing here? And the guy says, hey, I'm a person, you know, you're having a meeting. And he says, yeah, well, we're having a meeting, but it's special people with monks, and okay, I have to admit you're a person, but, you know, among all the people who are persons, you're not the one we intended to come to this meeting. Okay, that would be, since he answered, that's how Jetson Kava would answer. He did not answer by saying, hey, you're not even a person. Get out of here, you know. You're a dummy, you know. You know, he didn't say, get that dummy out of here. It's not even a person, you know. He didn't answer that way. He didn't say, that's not even an object, right? Rather, he said, among all those people called humans or persons, meaning among all those objects of the path of purity called objects of the path of purity, you know, we intended this one to be here. We didn't intend that one to be here, okay? Based on his answer, based on that answer, you'd have to say that it looks like the Sergei interpretation is a little closer than ours. Then the next phrase, which is the seventh line from the bottom on page 56, Dena means, therefore, in this system, right, even though something may not qualify as ultimate, as being an ultimate and as being an uncaused or an unproduced thing, as we've mentioned it here, right, still, it could be described in this school, it could qualify in this school as something ultimate in the sense of not being just a production of your mind, as something which does exist from its own side through its own unique way of being. What Jensel Kapa is saying is that something in this school could fail to be ultimate in the second sense of the term, yet still be called ultimate, because it would still qualify as ultimate in the first interpretation of the term. Okay, so that's Jensel Kapa is wrapping up like that. He's like saying, don't forget that in this school, even if something doesn't qualify as ultimate in the second sense of the term, meaning, you know, some kind of unproduced thing which is ultimate, still it could qualify as ultimate in being in being something which does exist from its own side through some very nature of its own, not just nominally, and still it could be called ultimate in this school, okay? Given that there are those two takes on the meaning ultimate. Nothing. So therefore, if somebody came along and said, hey, I'm thinking of an ultimate thing. I'm thinking of a thing that exists ultimately. Okay? First of all. Secondly, I'm going to tell you something. It's not one of those ultimate things that is an unproduced thing. Meaning what? No. What is the ultimate which is an unproduced thing? Yeah, Yondu. So I'm thinking of an ultimate. I'm not thinking of that one, okay? I'm thinking of one that that doesn't exist just nominally, okay? But it is something that we can describe in the mind-only school as existing ultimate. What am I thinking of? Shenwangs. Okay, I'm thinking of dependent things, okay? And they can be legally, properly described in this school with as ultimate in the first sense of the term, still. It says no contradiction in this system, no problem in this system. Now, what are they talking about when they say no problem? What are they referring back to when they say, hey, there's no problem? There were five. They're referring back to the middle way school making the accusation that how can you talk about a thing that's ultimate, okay, and is still a changing thing? How can you say that? You know, how can you talk about a thing which is produced and still talk about a thing which is ultimate, okay? There, that phrase in Tibetan, Mingyal, which means, hey, there's no problem here, there's no contradiction here, is a reference back to the original complaint of somebody, right? We said probably middle way school or somebody saying, hey, look, all those mind-only texts say that you can't be ultimate and still be a changing thing. You know, they say, wait, no problem. Why? Because there's two interpretations of what we mean when we say ultimate. Okay? So no problem, you middle way guys, or whoever it is that's complaining. Okay? Listen. Did you have an issue or a question? Tam Mingyal Sesa de Sude Nyema Lunga Tangendila or the government do this to see a symptom bay. Lunga Tangendilia. Not a Lunga Gangimindu. Yeah, that's right. He says. If we had to clean up, when we do our mop up, we'll get to that exact thing. Exactly what you said is in the mop up operation. when we mop up, we'll clear the good name of the mind-only school from these terrible accusations that were made in the ones that you refer, in those texts that you refer to. Nasa. Nasa.
That's
Now Jesakapa is pulling out another, opening another can of worms, okay? We got a quotation from a book called Yeshe Nimbukune Dupa, which Geshe-la identifies as a book by the Aryadeva, okay, Aryadeva, a great scholar of the Middle Way. And it says that book's name is called The Compendium, which is the Compendium of the Essence of Knowledge, or something like that, The Compendium of the Essence of Wisdom, okay? So in that book, Aryadeva says, describes Sundan Jimbaletu in Namshe, meaning a state of mind which is free of subject and object. Okay? A state of mind which is free of subject and object. And there are two interpretations of what it means to be free of subject and object. Okay? An aspect of subject and an aspect of object. Okay? In one sense, as you remember in the mind-only school, they say that a subject, mind, and the object which it's holding come from one seed and are therefore not of any separate substance. Okay, remember that? They're said to be not of any substance. They're said to be not of any separate substance. Why? Because they come from the same karmic seed. So in that sense, a state of mind can be free of subject and object. Okay. In another sense, in the mind-only school, we can describe certain states of mind as being free of subject and object because they are free of externally existing objects. They don't hold to externally existing objects because in this school they don't exist. Right? So then you can say that subjects are free of externally existing objects. So in that sense, certain states of mind are free of subject and object. So there's two different takes on what it means in Master Aryadeva's quotation when he says states of mind which are free of subject and object. Now what does he say about the subject and objects? He goes on to say, Dhamma Dundaya means they exist ultimately. And then he says in the last line, in the last line here, he says, Anyanjacha Bhishundu Dhat means, and that's what they say in the Yogacara system. Remember, Yogacara is a synonym for mind-only school. So here you got Aryadeva saying that these states of mind, described as they are according to the mind-only school, do exist ultimately. And he says, that's what the mind-only school believes. All right? Do we have a problem here or not? Okay. Jesakapa gives a very simple answer in last line, page 56. Hey, that's talking about ultimate in the first interpretation of the word. Okay, that's all. Okay, he just says that, you know, Jesakapa says, hey, they're just talking about ultimate in the first sense of the word, in the first interpretation of the word. That's all. Page 57, opening lines, okay? Geshe-la says, in a sense, you could say that the following lines are personal advice to us from Jesakapa. You know, he's like saying, okay, look, guys, I got something to tell you. Between you and me, okay, I got some advice on all these points. You know, listen to this and you won't have any trouble, okay? People are talking here. Who's talking? On one side, you got the middle way people. On the other side, you got the mind-only people. Here it says Yogacara. Same thing, says Geshe-la. Okay? Mind-only. I don't know what we're going to call them in English. We'll figure out a word, okay? You got any ideas? No. Later. Okay, so anyway, the Yogacara, which is equal to the mind-only. It's another name for mind-only, okay? On one side, we got middle way. On the other side, we got Yogacara. What are they fighting about? First of all, they're taking as their object shenwangs, right? Things which are dependent, things which come from their causes and conditions. And they are arguing about whether they exist or not?
No.
Okay? They're not, the fight is not over exist and not exist in the sense of existing or not existing. The fight is over, do they exist ultimately or don't they exist ultimately? You know, the question is this, the fight is over that. And in fact, you have to clarify that ultimately further, right? Because it means different things. Are they arguing about dependent things, existing or not existing, ultimately, in the second sense of the term? Are they arguing about whether or not dependent things are ultimate reality or are not ultimate reality?
No,
no they're not. Okay? He says, you got to get it clear. You have to divide ultimate. Existing ultimately has two different connotations. You have to be aware, you have to stay aware, that what they're arguing about is whether or not these dependent objects exist ultimately in the first sense of the word, okay? In the first connotation of the word. That's where the fight is about. Keep that in mind and you won't have any problems. Fail to keep that in mind and you'll get a lot of problems, okay? That's okay. Okay, quiz time. What do you guys think? You know, can the mind-only school come along and say that dependent things do exist ultimately in the second sense of the term?
No.
Sit your money. If they did say that, what would they be saying in effect? Jetsu Kapa is sensitive to this point, you know, that if they did say that, they'd end up saying that everything around us is ultimate reality. Therefore, he's saying you must distinguish between these two meanings of ultimate, and you must be sensitive to the fact that what we're fighting over is the first meaning of ultimate. You know, does it exist as simply a construct of the mind or not? Does it exist from its own, through its own unique way of being or not? Okay? That's where the fight is. It's not over whether or not it's ultimate reality. Okay? Page 57, line 4, Jetsun Kapa says, the twin masters, okay? Referring to Master Sangha and Master Vasubandhu, who were half-brothers, okay? It says, in most of their texts, okay, in most of the books that they wrote, when they talk about the ultimate, they are talking about ultimate reality, which is the latter sense of the term. But Geshe-la points out that the word most implies that it's not a kyaba, right? It's not necessarily the case that every time they mention the ultimate, they're talking about ultimate reality, okay? So you have to be sensitive to that. Most of the time, when these two half-brothers are talking about the ultimate, they're talking about ultimate reality, but not all the time. That's okay.
Nothing.
나서.
남도 없어. 나서. 아니, 콘도도 유, 디젠, 콘도도 유, 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 콘도도 유,
Nothing. This is a little bit tough. Fifth line from the top, page 57. It says, but the first two natures, how is it that they exist deceptively? Now, how is it that the first two natures exist deceptively? When they talk about the first two natures, they're talking about the first two attributes of the mind-only school, meaning, constructs, and dependent things. Okay, so then it says, they are something that exists deceptively in the second sense of the term. Okay, in the second sense of the term. Okay, as deceptive things, right? Deceptive reality, right? As something which is not emptiness itself. Okay, that's okay, right? So he says, now how is it that they exist deceptively in the second sense of the term, says Geshe-la, okay? We quote again the abbreviation of Arya Sangha, and it starts out and says, now Gyutsen and Namdoks, Gyutsen normally means reason, okay? Remember once that we glossed it as those things which exhibit causation, Tan Gyu, okay? And that means, that's referring now to what? Dependent things, Shenwang. Okay, so the word Gyutsen is a code word for dependent things, and Namdoks, meaning the constructing state of mind. Now, what group does that belong to?
What did you call it?
Constructs?
Constructs.
No, the constructing state of mind. Be careful. Oh, okay. Still belongs to Shenwang. It's just a particular kind of Shenwang. So the abbreviation of Arya Sangha is saying all of those things which are dependent, and among them that thing called the constructing state of mind, or you know, that imagining state of mind. Here's the reason why they are something that exists deceptively, okay? Well, first of all, because of involvement with mental affliction. Secondly, because of motivation. And thirdly, in the sense that they are the object of labels. Now, what does that mean? We got to see, okay? In the sense of being involved with mental affliction, in the sense of being involved with motivation, and in the sense of being the object of the labeling process. Now, what are those referred to? We're going to get later. Actually, there's only two parts of the last one. I made it three. It's only two. Okay. One is they motivate afflicted things. They're involved with motivation of afflicted things. So put those two together. Okay. They're involved with the motivation of afflicted things. A. B. They are the basis of labeling, or the basis of some kind of labeling. Okay? So those two. So I made a mistake. So make those three into two. The first two belong to one. They are that which motivates mental afflicted things. A. And then B, they are the basis or the foundation of the labeling. Nothing. 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 Lani. Shamne Geba. Lani. This is kind of cool. All right. How do we describe, in the second sense of the term, in the second interpretation of the term, something that exists ultimately? Right? How do we describe it? Remember that we described it as the ultimate object of the path of purity. Right? That thing which the direct perception of emptiness is focusing upon. That makes it Yongdrup or totality or emptiness. Okay? That makes it. That means out of the three groups of the mind-only school, out of the three attributes, you can only call emptiness or totality that thing which the path of purity or the direct perception of emptiness focuses upon. Okay? Don't forget why we call it the object of the path of purity. And where the purity comes in here. It comes in here. If you focus upon that thing, your obstacles will be purified. Okay? You will be purified of your obstacles. That's where path of purity comes from. That's where the purity in the path of purity comes from. In a sense, you could describe emptiness as that object which, if you can perceive it directly, you will begin to purify all of your obstacles. Purify yourself of all your obstacles. Okay? And that's a description of what it is to be ultimate or to exist ultimately in the second sense of the phrase, in the second interpretation of the phrase. Now, what if you wanted to describe what it meant for something to exist deceptively then? You know, what if you wanted to describe the ultimate, the opposite? And then he says, hey, just take that description of what it is to exist ultimately and reverse it. Just reverse it, okay? Now what do you come up with, okay? That object upon which if you focus upon it, you know, motivates or triggers all that mentally afflicted stuff, okay? That would be a good description for the opposite. You know, if you wanted to describe those things which existed deceptively, you could just flip around that other description and say, those things which, when you focus upon them, they trigger or motivate mentally afflicted stuff. Okay? And that's exactly the description of the other two groups. What are the other two groups? Constructs and dependent things. Shenwans and Kuntaks. So those can be described as existing deceptively insofar as when you focus upon them, as opposed to focusing on emptiness, they don't purify you of your obstacles. They actually tend to engender in you mentally afflicted stuff. Okay, and that's a way of describing them. Okay, that's what the first of those two phrases means, right? I mean, we had one that said they are the they motivate mentally afflicted stuff, and then we said they are the object or the basis for labeling. So now we finished the first of those two. And it's based on that need to reverse to get to the opposite that they said here they trigger mentally afflicted stuff. Nothing. An issue should have arisen in your mind. You know, when we start to describe those other two groups, meaning dependent things and constructs, as being things which only trigger mental affliction or something like that, there should have arisen some doubt in your mind. You know, hey, not every changing thing is all that bad, you know? I mean, it's not like every changing thing in the universe is bad. The Buddha himself You know, a fully enlightened being has lots of changing things in them, you know? And those are not like triggering mental afflictions or creating mental afflictions all the time or something like that, okay? And Geshe-la says, don't forget, way, way, way back at the beginning of the text, when they said, the reason we have to classify dependent things as mostly being on the afflicted side of things is that most of them relate to mentally afflicted things. Not all of them, okay? And that was why we had some characterizations such as they are peace from the beginning, you know? They are of a nature of being beyond all grief. And then they said, we can't use these words to describe the group called dependent things because they're not. Why? Because most of them are not, okay? And don't forget that distinction was made before. We couldn't apply those two beautiful expressions to dependent things because most of them related to mentally afflicted stuff, meaning not all of them relate to mentally afflicted stuff. And so it's with that in mind that here, those two groups, and specifically the group of dependent things, is referred to that stuff which triggers mentally afflicted things. Okay? That's all. That's all. And I'll prove it to you. Go back to page 22, line 2, you know? And there they're talking about, hey, why is it that those latter two expressions, which are peace from the beginning, and, you know, of a nature of being nirvana or passing, transcending beyond grief, why was it that this text itself said that those could not be applied to dependent things? Well, because most dependent things are involved with mental affliction, okay? So most dependent things have some kind of connection with mental affliction. And that's what they have in mind when they say here, when they describe dependent things as triggering mental afflictions or something that causes causes mental afflictions to arise, that motivates mental afflictions. And that's why you have to take this second reference as meaning most of them trigger mental affliction, okay? And this is just my own idea, okay? I mean, I'm just trying to think about what does that mean, you know? It says Geshe-la. That's what it is. Here we have to describe in more detail what it means to trigger a mental affliction, okay? What it means here when they say engender mental afflictions or cause mental afflictions to come up or trigger, you know, why do we have to say most here? Well, you know, there are, in enlightened beings, there are changing parts of them, like their physical appearance, okay? Which is, you know, if you're a person with certain incredible mental afflictions, whether it's desire, jealousy, hatred, all the way up to the tendency to see a self-nature of a person or something like that, when you focus on the Buddha, it's possible that you could have a mental affliction. It could trigger a mental affliction. Okay? So why do we have to say almost all? You see, in this idea, if you think of it this way, anything could trigger a mental affliction. I mean, meaning that if you looked at it, you could have a mental affliction. You could come down with a mental affliction, okay? So why is it that we have to say mostly? You have to be sensitive to the fact that the phrase here triggering mental afflictions or inspiring mental afflictions or something that is used in the sense of causing mental afflictions to get worse and worse and worse and bigger and bigger and bigger, okay? And you can't look upon a Buddha that long. You know, I mean, it's not like a normal object that would typically cause a typical state of mind to get worse and worse and worse and worse, okay? It's possible that you could look at an enlightened being and have some mental affliction and you know, due to your past karma or due to your own mental state or something like that. But if you constantly focused on this thing, you know, would it cause your mental afflictions to gradually worsen, worse and worse and worse and worse, typically? No, that's not the case. That's why Geshe La says we have to say here, it's only the majority of changing things that could be called triggerers of mental affliction. Okay, meaning triggering and causing to greatly increase in a gradually worsening way. Okay, nothing. I'll give you an example. You know, the Buddha had a half-brother named Devadatta. And whenever Devadatta was not in the direct presence of the Buddha, he would start thinking about how bad the Buddha was and start getting angry and start getting jealous and start disliking him intensely. But then when he got into the direct presence of the Buddha, you know, he was so overwhelmed. Every time he got in his presence, you know, he was so overwhelmed by the presence that all that hatred would melt away and he would just like, you know, say hi, you know, like that. So that's an example of that distinction. Okay. So we got two reasons why those first two groups of the mind-only school, the first two attributes, can be referred to as existing deceptively, right? And the first reason we went through already, we just reverse the description of what it is to exist ultimately, right? Existing ultimately means to be one of those objects, meaning totality or emptiness, which if you focus upon it, then gradually your obstacles are purified, okay? That by virtue of being the object of the path of purity, something qualifies as existing ultimately in the second meaning of the term, okay? In the second interpretation of the term. So what would it mean to exist deceptively by the same virtue? Just reverse it. That objects or those objects which, when you focus upon them, they tend to trigger and to cause to worsen your mental afflictions. Okay, so we finished really the first reason for calling those two groups something that exists deceptively. Okay, now we go on to the second one, which starts five lines from the bottom. It says, that very nature, meaning that nature here, very nature here is a code word in the mind-only school for one of their attributes. Okay, it's been since the beginning. That nature, or that very nature, which is of the nature of being labeled through thoughts and words, right? You can label something, you can call something something, either through a verbalization or through a thought. You know, you can think of it in a certain way, and that is a labeling, or you can speak of it in a certain way, and that is a labeling. Now, what is the one nature or attribute of the mind-only school which is the labeling or the construction of those two kinds of labels? That's kuntaks. Okay, those are constructs. Okay, so he's mentioning constructs, and then he says that thing which provides the basis for labels. Right. Remember that was the second reason for something to be existing deceptively. The first one was that it caused in inspired mental afflictions, and the second one it said it is the basis of labeling. Now, what do we mean when we say basis of labeling? Shenwangs or dependent things are the basis of labeling in two different senses. They are what A, constructs apply to, whether those constructs are verbally constructed or mentally constructed. Okay, that's the first way in which they are the label. And then secondly, they themselves provide directly the label to receive the name, okay, to receive the thought. Okay, so what is the construct is something that depends on the name and the thought. Constructing the construct depends on the name and the thought. But then the Shenwang itself, the changing thing itself, is what receives those names and what receives those constructs. They are the basis of both the constructs, and they are the basis of the names as well. Okay, of the names and the thoughts. Okay, so in those two senses, the second reason applies. Shenwangs or dependent things can be described as, now they say, existing nominally. So that's very sweet. I guess here you would have your locus classicus. You know, you'd have your classical description of what it is to exist deceptively, and now you've got, this is really a classical description of what it exists, what it means to exist nominally. Nominally meaning to be the basis upon the basis towards which names and thoughts and constructs are applied. Okay, and that's the second reason why those two groups or those two attributes of the mind-only school can be described as existing deceptively, and then by implication, existing nominally. We're going to get to it. There's a little bit more to leave, there's one more sentence that we got to come to next when we get back, and we'll take it and we'll glue it up to this conversation we just had. Okay, so remember that when we get back. There's going to be a line and a half more that we're going to have to pull up into this current discussion when we get back. Sanam yeshe ne chuve, tabakuni tabakuni.